Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Anand Patel.
And I'm Naomi Sheldon.
And we're your hosts of The Pleasure Podcast. I'm a doctor specialising in sexual function.
And I'm a writer with an interest in the intimate.
We talk to guests to help us understand the relationship we have with our bodies when it comes to sex and intimacy.
It's a whole new kind of sex education for your owl.
Careful.
Pleasure. Hello, and welcome back to Season 3 of The Pleasure Podcast. Thank you to all our listeners and guests who made the last two seasons possible.
We're so happy and grateful that you're getting as much out of hearing from people's perspectives on pleasure, sexuality and education as we do. It's confirmed our belief that sharing stories is a powerful way to cultivate understanding, tolerance and ultimately make us more connected with ourselves and the world.
And Season 3 is not going to disappoint. We're kicking off with a woman who needs little introduction. She truly is the nation's sweetheart. And not just because she talks openly about bonking Jeff Goldblum with a piece of toast stuck to her bum on the screen.
She is the recipient of so many accolades we'd take an hour to list them. So we'll introduce her as the Queen of our hearts, the leader of the good fight, the only person to win Academy Awards for both writing and acting. It's Dame Emma Thompson.
We spoke to Emma about how to come back to our instincts when it comes to erotica and pleasure, the sex handbook she made her daughter, why it's important never to shame your sister if you catch her wanking, and resistance against being squashed into shapes that society wants you to be.
Emma's astute ability to understand human behaviour is astonishing. At times, she becomes our therapist, fit to rival Esther Perel.
We hope this conversation inspires you, gets your brain buzzing, and helps you just a little to come back to what pleasure means to you.
I took to sex when I was 15, and I was taken by my mother to a very old, she was 90, gynecologist called Helena Wright, Dr. Helena Wright. And she had pioneered sex education and indeed the practice of taking birth control, the pill. And when I went to see her, I'll never forget it, this little old lady in a white coat said, "What is the birth control pill for?" And I said, "It's to stop you getting pregnant." And she said, "No, what's the birth control pill for?" And I couldn't think of what she meant. So I said, "I don't know what you're getting at." And she said, "It is in order for human beings to have sex for pleasure." Wow. That is what it is for. Now, of course, it was co-opted by the patriarchy, who decided that that's a really great way of making women feel that they can be sexual available. And that's a fab thing. I mean, look at, don't even talk about Silicon Valley and what's going on there with the sort of, oh, sex parties. If you don't go, you're not cool. All that stuff. Sex has, since the sex revolution, has been used by as a weapon by the patriarchy. And we have to push back on that and say, take your fucking... your fucking anal sex fantasies and your all of your fantasies, actually, about what women want and shove them up your own ass. Just take it away. Yeah. You know, it's a disaster for our kids and it's a disaster for sex and sexuality, which is such a beautiful thing, and erotica and eroticism. These are beautiful, beautiful things. But if you don't use your instincts, you don't come to them with instincts that haven't been deformed by expectation and by all the societal shapes that you're supposed to twist yourself into, then you don't really know which ones to trust. So that's why this conversation is so important. So people can go back to themselves and go, well, I'm not sure whether that instinct is right.
One of the reasons that we wanted to chat initially was because of this brilliant handbook that you'd made about sex and emotion for Gaia. We were wondering about, I mean, it's an unusual thing to do. I was talking to my mum about it and she went, my goodness, what a brave thing to do. And I thought, is it brave how we teach our daughters or our children about sex? Why is that a courageous thing? And I wondered what, and it is, but I wondered what it was that prompted you to do it.
Oh, blind terror, you know, that she would get into situations where she felt obliged, where she felt pushed. I was frightened of the societal pressure on her and her generation. You know, young men thinking they've got to get their what's known as brown wings, that anal sex is supposed to be your first stage. And you think of Fleabag, of Phoebe Waller-Bridge's first episode, you know, it's about anal sex, which was never on the agenda when I was a girl. And personally, I've always felt the arsehole was, you know, exclusively for waste disposal. So I was fascinated by that, and I was also frightened of it for her. So for me, it was a kind of a roadmap. And it was all about the different places in which we feel things. And the fact that we feel things in our heads. We actually feel things in our heads. We feel things in our chests, in our stomachs, which we're learning about now. The stomachs are the second brain, and that's all utterly fascinating. We're very complicated, and of course in our loins. And everything about sex in our society has either been completely bastardized, or has been oversimplified, or worse still, has been rejected as wrong and dirty. In the handbook, I suppose I was trying to suggest to her gently, not sort of telling, but suggesting and showing, that when three or more places in your body, your brain, your heart centre, your stomach and your loins all marry, then you're pretty safe. That's a safe space.
Yes.
Because each of those centres has different instincts. And you'll find that you might have a very strong instinct to have sex with somebody, but actually it's really not the right thing. Mm-hmm. And often kissing is exactly what's needed and nothing else. Or even cuddling and nothing else. You have to be able to make these choices and know what your body is really saying to you. Because your body might go, ooh, in the loins and in perhaps the heart area, you might go, I really fancy that person. And then you start talking to them and your brain goes, oh God, I'm so bored, I'm so bored. And then you have to deal with the discussion between your brain going, I don't think so. And your body going, yeah, but he or she or they are so hot, please, please. That kind of discussion has never been given a space.
You're right. It's so rare that we talk also about the different areas of the body which experience emotion and instinct and drive. It makes me think, the way you describe it, makes me think of the chakras.
It is the chakras,
when I
really.
See that, when I see those pictures of the different colours of on the head and the heart and the stomach and the loins.
There is this, as you say, sort of discordance, disconnect, challenge that you're getting from different parts of the body. And you describe it in your book as, or is it pamphlet, leaflet? What would you describe
it? It's a sort of little booklet with little gingerbread men where I've put all the feelings, you know, and the borders around your body that you can allow some things in and good things in and bad things not in, and all the ways in which we can protect ourselves, because safe sex is, as you say, a really complex matter. It's not just about putting a condom on or making sure that you've got birth control and all of those things.
It really struck me that actually you brought up your mum taking you at 15 to
Helena Wright,
and I was fascinated thinking that actually you talked to your mum at that age, and you were comfortable talking to your mum.
Not entirely, but I first of all talked to my wonderful cousin Eleanor, who was, I don't know whether you remember, there was a theatre called The Players, which was under the arches and the embankment, Players Bar, which used to be that where the late Victorian Joys would appear. And the late Victorian Joys were people like my cousin Eleanor, who would get up and sing, "Oh, Antonio, he's gone astray," with that sort of voice and a pair of bloomers on. So I told her first, who wouldn't? She said, "Oh, you must tell your mum, she'll be fine." And actually, mum was fine. She was a little bewildered by my fascination and enthusiasm for sex, because she had been brought up in Scotland by rather puritanical parents. Well, actually, that's unfair to say. My grandmother wasn't puritanical at all, but the system was, very much so. So I was lucky. I was very lucky. I can't say she wasn't judgmental about it, because she was, and who can blame her, really? She probably had the same worries as I did. When I wrote Gaia that booklet, you just worry, don't you, for your kids? But actually, there was really nothing to worry about. I think I was very lucky. But I was of that generation that came literally in between the sexual revolution, that is to say, the 60s and the pill and all of that, and AIDS. I was free of the burden of worrying about getting pregnant and the burden of worrying about catching death. I think I was told when I was little that giving myself pleasure was a bit iffy. Even if it wasn't actually wrong, it was a little bit, you know, that term onanism and sort of, oh, self-regarding masturbatory. Again, you know, it's a derogatory term. If someone's being masturbatory, they're sort of just wanking themselves off because, and it's, oh gosh, when you start to use the language, you realise how violent it is, how anti erotic it is, how anti-everything pleasurable it is. Masturbation is one of the ugliest words in the English language. Like, you're spitting into a cup.
Oh, yes, it is.
You know, it's
spitty.
Just masturbation. It's just so aggressive.
Yes.
So the language is extremely important as well. And we need to find new words for these things.
It seems a very Victorian thing to, and I think Foucault was right, I got it as if I quote Foucault, but I've just said that out loud.
Yeah, well, you know, nice one. I haven't read Foucault for 40 years and I didn't enjoy him much then. But yeah, go on.
No, but he was talking about how the Victorians ruined sex in the UK.
Oh, did he?
And he was talking about how the fact that we had attached this religious and cultural structure, so we'd had to turn words for sex into a sort of scientific institution rather than a sensual and erotic and warm and fun and playful conversation.
Indeed. That's it.
That's exactly what's happened.
Yeah. What you're saying is absolutely true about my upbringing, and I lived in this street, so I've been here for 60 years. So I'm proper, you know, starting to be an old person. Not in, I don't mean old in the sense of doddery, but I'm young and old at the same time in the sense that I've got the energy still to do what I want to do. But I also have a huge life to look back on and all the things that I've experienced. And because I'm impulsive, I've made lots of mistakes. So I'm quite wise after the fact. So mistakes are your friends, of course. But when I was a child, of about, I suppose, maybe 6 or 7. My sister, we shared a bedroom, and my sister found me masturbating on my front with my eyes closed. She didn't know what I was doing. She went to get my mum. I was away with the fairies. I was just lying there having a nice time. And I opened my eyes and suddenly found my mother and my sister staring at me. And my sister was 5 and my mum was looking amused. And I looked at them and my mum said, "Soph just wanted to know what you were doing." And I said, "You were just having a good old fan scratch." And I thought at the time, I felt a bit funny, but I didn't feel funny for very long because she didn't shame me.
Yeah. That's lovely.
She did not shame me. And one of the things in your play, which was so, so important, was the response of your body to an orgasm that you had produced for yourself. You know, orgasms are incredible feelings, however long or short-lived they are. They can be wonderful, wonderful feelings. And if you're able to do that for yourself, what an extraordinary gift. Mm. And the way you put it was so powerful and important. That this is something we can do for ourselves, and it's extremely healthy, it's very pleasurable, it's free, and it's not going to give you an STD, unless you've just dipped your hands into somebody's bum. You know, you're going to be fine. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So then, as I was coming home from school for a long, long time, there was a kind of strange pawn shop. I guess it must have been a kind of dirty magazine shop or something. But I remember to tell you about this because it made me think of what kids are looking at now. But in the window, there was a picture of a man with a very angry face and a woman turned away with her head turned away and a grimace on her face. And he had one breast clutched in his hand. He was squeezing it really hard. And it was a violent image, but supposed to be titillating. And I remember being so deeply disturbed by this. And this was when I was going to school, proper school, 11, 12 years old. And I think about what kids now see at a very young age on phones and go, there's something really proper fucked up about this. Because what they're seeing is not representative of anything other than, you know, the use of women's bodies mostly. So, you know, we're up against it. And conversation, eye to eye, is absolutely the only way we can come to terms with a huge machine that is bearing down on us, which is consumer capitalism, you know, not being able to get away from the things that we are supposed to have and like and use all the time.
Talking of capitalism, I was thinking about how, I suppose, when we're thinking about masturbation, about that moment in the play and working out about what works for you and your body, that can take time. It can take time. Yes. And really, you need to be able to afford yourself sort of a languid experience of exploration and not aiming for a goal. And there's something very anti-capitalist about it, because it's not about function, bam, go back to work and you're relieved. It's about actually just taking time out of all of that. And who knows what the goal is, other than just purely for sheer pleasure, actually.
I remember I used to talk about, and you pulled me up on this, which is as it always should be, about almost learning how to give someone an orgasm as if it's a rote exercise. As in, if I can learn to be good at it, because I like to be good at things, it's like a surgical procedure. It's like, you know, there is a set way of doing something.
Yes.
And you've taught me actually a lot of it is about, well, you can achieve an endpoint in lots of different ways.
Yes. And it might not be to come, actually.
No, and that might not be your endpoint, or it might be a part point, partway point, a sort of a stopping point.
Absolutely. That whole thing is just, I mean, pleasure is time. Time. I can remember having the most wonderful night with a boyfriend, and we touched hands only. You know, and it wasn't about deeply sexual experience, but it was about a deeply intimate experience. And there are so many demands on everybody's time. And it's true that to give yourself the space in which things arise, not to put, you know, not to make a pun of it, you know, because of course it's not all about the male organ being such an obvious thing. That was another thing I did actually when Gaia was very young. She came to me, she was about 8. She said, "Mum, I've asked a lot of people about sex, what actually happens, and no one will tell me. Will you tell me?" I said, I remember where I was sitting. I remember I was sitting down and she came up to my head. She was sort of same height as me sitting down. So she must have been about 8. I said, okay, here's the mechanics. And I just drew a picture and said, this is a bit alarming because it changes shape and it's a thing outside the body. And that's what happens. She just looked at me and she just said, "I knew you'd tell me the truth." As if the truth were just the worst thing anyone could ever have expressed, which, of course, at 8, it is. What a horrible idea. Yeah. So Victorians, it's so true that I wrote a sketch when I was writing sketches about a woman coming back from her marriage bed, as it were, saying, you know, that she was very confused because her husband has shown her his penis and said, "Do you know what this is?" And it starts to change shape and she's gone, "I think it must be something." Anyway, she's come to talk to her mother about it, who can't, of course, say anything. Which in turn was based on an Edith Wharton story, which is about a young woman going back to see her mother and to challenge her mother and accuse her mother because her mother knowingly married her off to someone who she knew would be brutal. And in our present day world, the amount of brutality towards female sexuality is, it's terrible. So I've sat in African countries, Liberia, Ethiopia, talking to women whose experiences of FGM are very real, who actually say, when we talk about pleasure, that's not allowed. It's simply not allowed. So we're living in 2020 on an earth where many women, many, many millions of women will not ever experience an orgasm, ever. They won't have sexual pleasure. So there's this very far edge of violence against female pleasure that is very real and absolutely alive in our world today. Yes. And there's elements of it in our society. Yes. As well. So, you know, that's why I made her the handbook, because I know about that stuff and I know it in very intimate detail, slightly too intimate sometimes, because it is utterly horrifying when you really go and talk to them.
Yes.
How do you gauge it though? Because how do you think, you know, you know all of this. So what do you distill into a booklet for a 12-year-old? I mean, I don't know how old she was when you gave it.
I think she was 12.
involved?
You don't, that's not to go into, that's not necessary at this point in time at all. But you go right back to the safe place and describe the safe place. And the unsafe place is that wrong feeling that you get, that icky feeling that you get, which I'm sure you can both remember very clearly when someone's done something that's completely inappropriate, like the time when I was 8 and the magician stuck his tongue in my mouth. That wasn't right.
I read about this.
He was about 60 or so. It was a buried memory as well.
Wow.
And that's the worst thing that happened to me when I was a kid. And when you think about what happens to folk, that's nothing. And that gave me a very nasty... Well, I mean, I suppressed it. I actually suppressed the memory. So being able to identify what really actually does feel good and be able to protest when part of it feels good but part of it feels wrong, all of these calibrations, which are complex and which we are really allowed to explore and need to learn about, but they do, as you so rightly say, take time. And you've got also got to be able to experiment and make mistakes with your body. It's your body. We make mistakes with it and go, well, I won't do that again.
Yes.
I won't be trying that one again.
And not to be frightened, I suppose, of being somehow altered forever from it. Or if you are, not in a scarring way that you can't then get over. I was interested to hear you say that you're impulsive and got into situations which, you know, you learned lessons from. I mean, absolutely, I hear you, because me too.
Yeah.
But I suppose I had been warned over and over in my early teens, because I started being sexual at a very young age, lost my virginity at 13, and, you know, was very sexual from a young age.
Yes,
I didn't
so
know
was I.
What I was doing.
No, it was very recreational and very joyful.
Yeah.
Very joyful. No, I hadn't, well, didn't feel ashamed about it at all.
Yes, yeah.
God, so extraordinary. I felt completely the opposite. I didn't lose my virginity until I was 19. And even then, it felt like just something I needed to do with someone I didn't find attractive. Just because then you could have got it over with. There's a hearing you
say... That's an achievement thing, isn't it?
Yes.
That's blokes going, oh, you've got to copy yourself. Oh,
but also, I finally told myself that I was gay. One awful thing was I remember getting myself drunk enough to approach a woman, a girl that I thought was unattractive enough that she might say yes to kiss me. And that's an awful story. And I recognise that being awful. But I also recognise me thinking, you're not an attractive person. You have to try and be like everyone else. Try and be with someone who might actually agree to be with you.
Yes.
And it's weird, but that voice when you're 13 or 14 is not the more, you know, cultured, thoughtful, moral, one hopes, person now. I mean, I wouldn't suggest practising on someone. And I recognise how awful it sounds. But anyway,
it doesn't sound awful at all. You're struggling with all the things you'd been told were wrong. So you couldn't be you and you couldn't follow your instincts. So that's what I mean.
And it was
by the shape that you were forced into, which is, no, I'm something I'm not. I can't dare to be who I am. Your instincts just get very... Mm-hmm. It's the steering wheel, isn't it?
Yeah.
The instincts are the steering wheel. And so it's, I think what you say as well is terribly important, that make these mistakes and then wait and give yourself time to come back to your steering wheel.
Yes.
Give yourself time to rebalance and go, well, that wasn't very comfortable, but I'm not quite sure why.
Yes. So difficult when out society, and maybe things have changed a bit, which I don't know how much, will label you once you've made those mistakes.
Oh, absolutely. I was labelled. I can remember having a conversation about sexuality with a journalist years and years ago when I was in my 20s. And the tabloids took this up and went with it and just, you know, went. They were just so prurient and twatty, like they are and they still are. And I realised they suddenly turned into a sort of bunch of little old, very Christian people with knitting needles clacking away, going, oh, what are you doing? And I thought, oh my goodness, that's a common response to any discussion about the joy of sexuality and the abandon and the freedom and the exchange, the free exchange of these wonderful feelings that is such something so to be wished for devoutly, obviously, and isn't readily available when it really should be. It really should be, because it's free and it's easy, but it has to be commercialized or it's been put into so many different categories. And we have to somehow, through these conversations, release it from these categories because it doesn't belong there.
I've just had a bit of a light bulb moment, actually.
Oh yeah, go on.
From thinking about when I was, 12, 13, I was so curious about bodies and intimacy, although I wouldn't have been able to know that that was the word. I was always asking my mum, what's sex like? What's breastfeeding like? Yes. I wanted to know what the physical experience of things was like. And she would, bless her, try her very best to answer. It's relaxing. It's this. It's all whatever yes. it is. But I would be so curious.
Relaxing? Not really.
Set
anyway,
me up
go
for
on.
A failure. Yeah. And I remember having a lot of baths with her, for example, not in a sexual way at all, but in an intimate sort of mother-daughter way. And then having a friend who was a boy, who then I wanted to have a bath with, and because I wanted that same intimacy.
Yes.
And then I'm wanting to know, I don't know what touch was like. And I suppose until recently, till possibly today, I still look at that person and go, gosh, was she a bit fucked up? Why was I at the age of 11, 12, 13, so keen to be having these physical experiences? And funnily enough, as soon as people heard that I'd had a bath with a boy, they went, well, she's slag.
Mm.
And once I was given that label, I fulfilled it. And I wasn't a slag, and I'm not slut-shaming at all. But I felt like, oh, okay, so that's who I am. So I have sex with boys then. So I do. I was given a label, and I was sort of relieved to be told what I was, because no one else was curious.
And what you were was a writer and a poet. That's what you are. And that's why from a very young age, because not everyone's like that. Some people are completely disinterested. But you're interested because you're interested in describing in poetry and in your work. In life, you're a writer, actually, and you were a writer right from the get-go. The point is, that's a shape that you were put into.
Yes.
Which was nothing to do with you.
Yes.
Actually, it's just an outside shape, like for you, Anand, same thing. It's an outside shape, and you're squashed into it like you're some sort of weird human marshmallow that can just fit into these stupid definitions.
Yes.
Of what it is to be a human being. Yes. All of these stupid, useless, empty definitions that are husks and need to be just thrown into the landfill.
Yes. Looking back now, that actually was joyful and, as you say, free and didn't need to be shamed.
No. Sorry. Or marked as X.
Yes.
Mm. It was just you having a go at something. Yes. And those explorations seem to be far more limited, or at least now photographed and documented, and everyone seems to know everything about everyone immediately. And I'm like, well, how do you know that when you make a mistake and everyone's amplifying it out there?
Should we talk about that? Should we talk about a little bit about privacy and the importance of privacy? Yes. Because it seems to me anyway, as an old person, that privacy has now gone. And that young people no longer have privacy because everything is documented. Now, that seems to me to change. It must change one's relationship with one's steering wheel, inner instinctive steering wheel, because one must, under such circumstances, constantly be self...
Censoring,
or at least you're controlling something.
That's how I presume you must behave.
Why?
Because you are in the public eye.
Different thing, okay. Anand, different thing. Because if you've chosen a profession that creates a public persona, by my age, you've differentiated yourself from the public persona. You have yourself, your private person, and the public persona is like a kind of good thing that you just put stuff in. And that's a whole different thing. As it were, I live a private life. When it's private, it's literally completely private. No one sees me. People can barely ring me. You know, there's no pictures. There's no photographs. There's no Wi-Fi. So it's a completely private life. And within that, you know, definitely resides my erotic soul.
Which makes me think that actually people are now, and by the way, we're probably all too old to speak about this.
I think we are, yeah. Like, I mean, Gaia would be a very good person to speak to about it, because she seems to me constantly to be on her screen. But that's where life's lived.
And I feel that people are curating their lives and making their persona. I've got these sort of second cousins who are of that age, and I see the photos of them, and they're all always in, and this is not, I'm not saying this in a shaming way at all, it's just observing, they're beautiful to begin with, but it's all legs and tiny, you know, shorts and crop tops and perfect poses, and they have so many followers, it's unbelievable.
Because they accord with the accepted beauty myth norm.
Yes.
Which actually is a sort of mimetic thing that we're all very keen on mimicking the kind of pinnacle people. And all the pinnacle women are very thin. I think we've just been copying the rich for so long. Yeah, we're just like copying Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yes.
Oh, good.
And then buying
things from
the
jade vaginal eggs.
Yes.
Well, oh, you've heard about the candle, of course.
Yeah, my candle smells like a vagina. Yeah, I sent that to Bill Bailey. I knew he'd want one immediately. And that thinness is which is part of our profession as well, but she's a businesswoman, is also indirect kind of contravention of anything to do with pleasure. Because a woman who has appetites is not acceptable, viz Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. No, you've got to eat before you go to the party, otherwise you'll look like a woman who has an appetite. Mm. So women who have appetites have always been mistrusted. In our Christian society, it may go differently in other societies, yes. But in our world, if someone who's greedy, it might take some of the cakes from the boys, might end up wanting to have their own way, might end up with different ideas about where they belong, which is under and not at an unequal level. So appetite has always been suspected.
That's so interesting, because I was going to ask, actually, what is it, or to discuss, what is it about pleasure that is so radical and revolutionary that it must be squashed and suppressed and kept away from women? What is it? And actually, if you make that analogy, if it is about underlining the idea that a woman with appetite, with desires, it might be somebody to rip the rug out from under the ruling whoever at the time, well, that makes a lot of sense then, doesn't it? Because they are radical.
Mm. So everything about women's appetite, sexual appetite for food, appetite for experience, appetite must be suppressed, because otherwise we will become uncontrollable, and that can't happen.
Do you think things are changing?
Yeah, they are changing, absolutely. They're definitely changing. We're having this conversation, which is an enormous change from even 100 years ago, although many women were talking about these things in very radical ways hundreds of years ago, actually. But they are changing, but it's slow and it's extremely uneven, depending on where you are. We have to keep reminding ourselves that human progress is not linear in the same way as one human being's process is not linear. We can go thundering backwards in terms of our understanding of ourselves and what we need if we don't keep talking and communicating and squashing repression of any kind when it comes up and saying, that's not acceptable.
Yes, yes.
So this conversation is a political act. It's very important.
This is a conversation I would never want to have when I was younger. I would be too shy. I wouldn't have the words to speak about. I wouldn't want to talk about myself. I wouldn't want to be seen as someone who might talk like that, because I didn't want to step out of line. I didn't want to be seen as other.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because of what you were saying, Emma, about the ick and about no and about trusting your instincts. And I suppose a lot of our upbringings, which is about, as you say, not wanting to be other, not wanting to rock the boat, not wanting to say no, actually, and wanting to be compliant and amenable and saying yes, that we so often tell ourselves not to listen to the ick feeling in order to comply, that you lose the ability, actually, to be able to tell the difference between what feels right and what feels wrong. Mm. So I think the talking about conversation and communication, I do think that needs to come back into our bedrooms as well as a political act, to be able to go, actually, no, that's not, even if it's with, you know, whether we're talking casual sex, we're talking long-term partners, we're talking whatever, I feel like we need to be able to start just to speak in the room. I was chatting to my husband this morning about how he felt for a long time that that really you have to compartmentalize body and mind. So that because he's a very cerebral guy, was never very sporty growing up. So teachers would say to him, sport's not for you, the books are for you. Mm. And took a long time for him to start to use his, now he, you know.
Goes to the gym constantly, he's got a whipcord body.
He's got a hat bad. but it took a long time for him to be able to like inhabit it. Mm. And that happens in the bedroom as well. You know, actually this is a physical activity and we won't talk about it. And to be able to start, even, you know, as loving partners who have been together for a long time. Yeah. And only now, 10 years after having been together, have we started to be able to actually have a conversation about, you know what, that doesn't feel very good. Or can we try this? Or whatever it might be. But just starting to hook in with feelings. And obviously that's not as strong as like going, no, I don't want this to happen with this person I don't know very well, or I do know, but it's inappropriate. It's a very different situation I'm describing. But I think that even those small change of trajectories is quite important.
Huge. Mm. And in those conversations, which are about subtlety.
Yes.
Subtlety is another thing. We must recognise that all human beings are subtle. We are subtle and complicated. That's not what systems want. Our systems want us to be simple as possible. Our systems give us shapes that we must fit into, because then we can be organised and accounted for and repressed, actually, a lot of the time, whether we're women, whether we're gay, whatever. So our systems don't serve us very well, emotionally, not at all, actually. And it's about time we introduced the subtlety of our emotions and our instincts into our systems. And we will not survive as a species if we don't do that. And that's what the climate change crisis is all about. And interestingly, there's been a lot of research on the fact that some men who are deeply involved in the sort of assertive, aggressive, patriarchal version of maleness, which is what I would call toxicity, the toxic male, find if they express concern about the planet and a desire to help to save the planet, they will be seen as gay in all the bad versions of that. Mm. And isn't that interesting? That in fact, to care. Evince that to care is just not, it's not blokey.
It's weakness.
It's weakness. It's weakness. It's the excision of the feminine in your personality, and the fact that we cannot accept, or we have created systems in which we cannot accept, that all human emotion is contained in every human being and all human qualities are contained in every human being. And we have access to all of those things, but we are constantly told that we are not allowed access to this or to that thing. And that is how we are deformed by our systems. And this is all instinct, and it all relates to sex. It relates to everything.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
To quote Sarah Pascoe's phrase, well, she talks about it in her book, I don't think she coined it, but erotic capital. I was wondering whether you feel that as you've gotten older, the way that you've been asked to present female sexuality has changed?
Well, I've never been a pinnacle woman or Gwyneth Paltrow type. So I didn't ever fit the norms that are generally required to become a sexually castable person. Mm. I mean, if we're talking Hollywood or even here, the profoundly prescriptive and sexist responses to women's shapes and who they were, and in a sense was outside that a little bit because I've always been a character actor.
Did that feel like a relief at all?
Oh yes. But interestingly, it felt like a relief, but also if I received a script that described the character that I was going to go up for as beautiful, I wouldn't go up for the role. Because I just go, well, that's not for me, so I won't do that. So I was both relieved by it, but also oppressed by it, of course. So, yes, as you get older, you're relieved of all of that. But I haven't had the same kind of trajectory as somebody like, I don't know, Michelle Pfeiffer, which must be very hard when you're considered a great screen beauty. And then to see that drifting away, I don't notice it really.
Yeah.
But that's because I've done other things. And because, you know, I have a very political response to it. Mm. Which is a kind of energy in itself. Sarah's phrase, erotic capital, is very good, but she would always have had that, whereas I never did.
I find it so, I find it strange to hear that, because you are so beautiful.
It's perceptual, though. It's self-perception, isn't
it? It's self-perception, yes. And perhaps also self-protection, because you want to go, well, I don't want to feel that, so I will be proud and I will reject that naming ceremony.
I mean, I just want to know about sort of the middle phase of you know, of your life in terms of what sort of how menopause was for you, in terms of how you felt about your body or how
I've
you
always
felt
wanted
yourself.
To write. I think we should write a sitcom about the menopause at some point. That would be very, very interesting. For me, like my mum, I didn't really notice it very much. I had the occasional hot flush, which I found at night, which I found fascinating because I just thought, that's a tremendous amount of energy. Look at all that heat. It's quite extraordinary. We should harness that in some way. I feel like I could power the Chrysler Building right now. So that was interesting. I have no female hormones now. None. No hormones. And I mean, I can't say I miss them. But of course, afterwards, you're free of so much. And you've become something else. It's fantastic. Can you imagine? No more periods.
Is that the real relief?
Well, I mean, I didn't feel relief about it because I didn't need to have periods anymore because I'd had my baby and my family was built, the family that I wanted. But it is a great big thing to stop.
So there are no cycles happening anymore. I'm so a slave to my estrogen.
Yes.
And I have very short, fast cycles, 3 weeks.
Ah.
And so I feel I'm constantly in the middle of the cycle.
You are.
And I can't imagine not being at a point in a cycle.
No.
It sounds utterly exhausting.
It is exhausting, especially yours. And again, this is a whole other area, the female reproductive system and female hormones and male hormones. The hormones, which are one of our most powerful things and one of our subtlest things. So they are at the same time massively powerful and it's massively subtle, which is a sort of oxymoron in a way. You can't think, well, how can something really powerful is a big thing, because that's how we think of the world, because that's the patriarchal view of power. Is, you know, it's the Putin version of power. But actually, real power is unbelievably subtle. And hormones are subtle. You know, thyroxin, subtle. The things that the pancreas delivers, subtle. Adrenaline, subtle, but so powerful. What it does to us, so powerful. But the actual injection, the actual amount, those things to me are infinitely fascinating, because they can knock you out faster than any boxer, and it's just your body, and it's this understanding of our power and our subtlety that I think is missing from all of our mythologies, that I think these conversations are so useful to bring up and help people to think about. In what ways am I feeling powerful now? What is this subtle thing that is happening to me that is making me feel such enormous change.
And it's what you were talking a little bit about pain as well, earlier on, about pain and sadness. Mm. And for me, during certain periods of the cycle, there is great pain and sadness.
Yes.
And, I don't know, akin to depression in many ways.
Yes, absolutely.
And to be able to think about, well, okay, let's not try and ignore that or repress it or be ashamed of it. But how do I harness it? I'm going to use it in my writing. I'm going to use it to access X, Y, Z. And to be taught to harness, welcome in some of those emotions and feelings. Very different if people have endometriosis, etc.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. That's completely other.
But when it's hormonal, which feels like it's changing your personality, but trying to use it rather than be ashamed or be seen as hysterical or a loose cannon or whatever.
Well, which is what we're told we are. So again, that's an external thing coming in, and your borderline, your borders, which as you get older, you learn to calibrate very finely. Your borders say, no, I'm not taking that. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. And also your internal borders, because your superego, the punitive voice in your head, which everyone has, saying, that's stupid, you're stupid, this is stupid, that's wrong, which isn't the only comes from outside. It's also something I think that's inside humans. I mean, I don't know, it's difficult to tell. You'd have to do such a huge... You'd have to undo so many things to find out whether it comes from outside. But let us say it is in everyone. And you have to learn to be able to accept the voice and say, you're not what I need right now, and you're going to have to be quiet. I'm so sorry, but that's not appropriate. So in a sense, I have a political relationship with my own ego.
Yeah.
I say, that's not appropriate. I'm not. That voice, that tone of voice you've just taken with me about the fact that I, whatever it is, doesn't matter, is not appropriate, and I will not have it. And when you take those decisions, it's extraordinary what you can shut up. Our friend Jess Butcher calls it shit FM.
Oh, I'm tuned into that.
Oh, we're all tuned into that. I bet you are too, Anna.
Mine's got a lot better recently. Really good. I've been going to therapy, which has been very helpful.
Tremendously helpful.
Instead of dealing with the initial stuff, which is like firefighting for the first 6 months or so, you then actually try and start doing the work. And I specifically switched off my emotional response to things. So part of that was being a young, growing up an Asian boy,
gay person.
Asian gay person, and then it was actually at work does it to me, and I recognise in some ways my work damages me, because I'm naturally, I think, quite an open, giving, caring person. But if you want that from me in 10 milli aliquots 40 times a day, I can't deal with all of that emotion.
There was a very useful distinction that was made to me a few years ago by the great Mike Nichols. He said, people are either porous or metallic. If you think about it for a moment, it's very useful. You're porous. We are all porous, for all the obvious reasons. And I'm sure that you can immediately think of a few people you know who are metallic. So when in Guy's Little Handbook, you know, around the little gingerbread person, because the people are genderless, the feelings are in colours. And, you know, the icky feelings are sort of grey. Because the icky feeling, it leads to depression, because the icky feeling is shame, actually. And shame is probably, of all human emotions, the most prevalent and the most damaging. Shame and guilt. Remorse is different, because that's something you can do something about. I feel remorse about something I've done. I can express an apology, or I can do something about it. Shame... Hannah Gadsby writes very beautifully about shame, brilliantly about shame. And she describes her childhood. She said, I was soaked in shame as a child. And you can't make that better, because the childhood experience is so important, which is why I'm so grateful to my mother for not shaming me. And for not, whilst I did have to deal with certain moments of, oh, I'm not sure, I don't think that I ever had to deal with what Hannah's describing, which I think many people have to deal with. So around you, around the gingerbread figure, is a dotted line, as it were, a hyphenated line, which is the border that you put around your emotional self that allows good things to come in and that rejects too much negativity. Because, you know, you're be receiving a tremendous number of what the therapists, well, in fact, the psychoanalysts call projections. And doctors perceive them more than anyone, you know. So it's hardly surprising that doctors often drink and self-medicate in all kinds of ways, because it's a hugely difficult profession. And because it's been enshrined in science, and because science has been enshrined in not feeling, which young scientists will tell you is rubbish, that science is all about passion and poetry. Again, this is about systems we've created that are not serving us, because they don't recognise the human subtlety and the sort of inspirational human complexity, which is what we're going to have to really build on now and explore now more.
Very hard to tell a difference sometimes, I think, between shame and remorse, or not to welcome in shame as a sort of, as a, in a punitive way. I deserve it, I deserve it. If I feel the shame, then somehow I'm paying for what I've done or what I am. I think it's quite hard sometimes, again, about subtlety, to tell the difference between what is useful.
Do you mean shame and remorse, or shame and guilt? Remorse is, I've done something terrible, I can make amends for. Shame and guilt are often directed at the self for no good reason.
Yes.
They're connected to acts that are not wrong.
Yes.
They're connected to being or ways of being that are not wrong.
Yes.
But they have been described as such by the outside world. This is the problem.
Yes.
So we're up against it, you know, which is why all of these discussions, the more we talk about them, the more enlightened we become, the better able we are to create these useful boundaries.
Yes.
Within and without.
Yes.
I think this podcast has made a massive difference.
To
the way I think about the world, the way I think about people in general.
Yeah.
I'm much kinder. Often you pigeonhole people, you go, well, that's the diagnosis. And, you know, you listen to a story and you go, right, you jump to a conclusion quite rapidly. Mm. Whereas this has taught me to give a bit more space. But also the people that we are, I think, are probably slightly different. In the ways, the way I behave with my partner is different.
Mm.
And much more joyful and playful than it was.
Yes, me too. Mm. Far more joyful and playful. Mm. And it makes me think about, my dad wrote a porno, when you talk about that scene in The Tall Guy.
Yes.
With Jeff Goldblum. And that scene, that fabulously joyful scene.
The sex
which
scene.
I then saw. And I mean, I laughed so much. There are moments in that where I'm thinking, but how is they even, that doesn't, how are they?
And it's all us. There weren't any bloody stand-ins like in Love Bloody actually. No, it was us.
Yes.
Every 2 days nude. Toes stuck to our arses.
How is it to be asked to do that though?
Well, one expects to be asked to do that.
Okay.
In our profession. And that, it's a very tender thing to do. But it's, God, we were scared.
Yes.
Both of us, very scared.
I mean, did you communicate that to each other?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, you have to be very brave to take your clothes off in front of a crew, and you have to be very, very courageous. But you also have to be very, you've got to be protected, and it's much better now in our profession because, you know, 10 years ago when people were just starting off in television, so take your clothes off, girls, mostly, and they go, well, I better do it. I feel icky about this. I don't feel right about it. And the Harvey Weinstein story is absolutely key in this constant negotiation we have to have with our feelings, our instincts, and things that we may desire, and the ways in which they've been used to punish people. Whilst he's on trial, there are lawyers out saying these women wanted careers from him, so that's why they, you know. And you go, well, that's just so punitively wrong. There are no words. But you might think to yourself, oh, if you're in a situation where someone who's very powerful in your world wants something from you, and you feel as though you're going to get something in return, well, what's that negotiation about? Where does it take place? How do you make that decision? And actually, certainly in the Weinstein situation, there's no, that's coercion, full stop. But there are subtle versions of deals that one will make with oneself, I'm sure, in all sorts of situations. Not necessarily really on a sexual level, but even in a conversation, somebody might say something, you think, am I going to fight that fight right now? Am I going to do that? How do I feel about that? Will I walk away from that and feel bad?
I think the nuance I meant was not the nuance of coercion or not, was the nuance of the deals you make with yourself, the bartering you do with yourself to either make the situation which you hate being in functional so you can actually get through that day, and the stories you tell yourself about why you did it, whether that story is true or not, or is it just if it's just for to allow you to move on to the next stage.
And deals that are difficult. Nuance is right. So on the one end of that scale of judgment is you're in a situation with your partner who has just done something you don't like, or you need to tell them something, and you're thinking, I wonder if that was a bit mistimed. And on the other end of that same scale is I'm going to do something I really know I don't want to do because it's expected of me. So I suppose that's the nuance of compromise and self-knowledge. And
one will feed the other, I think, I feel as well.
Yes.
So, for example, for quite a long time in my private life, I felt very resentful and angry, mm-hmm. because I had allowed so many things to happen in more public life, or being nude on stage very early on, twice actually, my two jobs back to back nude at the beginning of my career, and feeling actually it wasn't handled necessarily always particularly well, and actually that fed into my private life. Suddenly I actually, there was not up for nuance or negotiation, because I was so furious at having been allowed things to have been taken advantage of there, that I just directed all that energy in my private life, which actually wasn't that helpful. I was fighting the wrong battle.
You're fighting the right battle in the wrong place.
Yes.
That's the point. Yeah. And that's really a fantastic thing to be aware of, you know, where do these things end up? Which is why a constant communication with your instincts in as honest and accepting a way as you can will prevent that from happening. You know, two examples, side to side. My friend who was felt up on the tube said the worst thing was that she didn't do anything about it, and it made her feel ashamed. And in fact, she had nothing to be ashamed about. Someone had done her wrong. Someone had abused her on the tube, and she was the one who ended up feeling bad about it, which is where I think shame is useless to us, useless and destructive. And on the literally the opposite thing, it was when I was about to be taken advantage of at the age of 20 or something by somebody, a much older man who reached towards me to put his hand down my shirt, and I just grabbed his wrist and said, I think you're taking advantage. And immediately he kind of took his hand or stopped, you know, because he knew he was taking advantage. He knew. So as soon as I described it, as soon as I'd used the words taking advantage, his shame instinct kicked in, stopped him from doing it, and protected me from my own feelings of shame. It's a hugely powerful thing to be able to say no in the right way.
Yes. But did he lash out? Because obviously no, sometimes when people feel shame themselves, they lash out to the other person.
Absolutely. That is also a possibility.
And that's what makes people worry, doesn't it? Yes, about absolutely. Actually going, I didn't want to stop that because he or they were bigger than me, or there are other reasons.
I knew he wasn't going to hit me or get violent. I knew he was someone who was just trying it on. Mm. So again, we learn. But, you know, if you've had an experience where you've said no and no one's listened, then as you do as a child, you're in deep shit later on. As you know, psychologically, it's very difficult to go back on that. But going back to something else you said earlier, it is extremely important that we are not defined by the terrible experiences we go through, because they can be metabolized. So one of my best friends, a great, great, extraordinary woman, experienced trafficking in the worst possible way. I mean, a story that just curls your hair. And someone who, through this long process of therapeutic process and storytelling, and is now a happily married woman who has completely survived. But she's had to put those experiences in a particular place. As I was describing before, the public persona. And it's very useful, I think, to think of yourself as a house or a mansion or a place in which there are rooms in which you can actually put stuff and visit it when necessary. You don't have to carry everything around all the time. You can have a house that you can leave. Just leave that stuff there.
I think some people feel that you should, not force, but that people should immediately talk about something bad that's happened to them. And it's just that some people react really well to that, being able to express what happened, and others find that really challenging and really damaging to have to express that harm that was happened to them. And they'll park it for now. And you suppress that magician. You might suppress it for a while. It may come back, but it might not.
Mm-hmm.
And people, we've had some people who have been abused in various ways, and they go, I don't feel I was abused. Actually, that was just something I have dealt with, and I do not see myself as an abused person.
But we are infinitely various. I mean, everything we're talking about goes back to the same thing. We are not allowed to be as complicated as we are, or as subtle as we are, or as different as we are. We've got to fit, because that's how we can be sold to, and sold to one another.
Which is why stories, I think, and conversation is so important, because we start to go, oh, this subtlety, or that nuance, or that person, oh, me too, or completely different to me, or, and so suddenly the palette widens and our minds and viewpoints expand.
Yes.
On the converse, though, of when we are sold a repeated diet of the same story. So we're told that romantic love is achieved linearly. Mm. You don't have 10 years later where the princess is terribly pissed off now.
Yeah. And no one's having sex anymore.
It's so true.
And that's the thing about the liminal experience right at the beginning, where your dopamine is firing beyond anything else.
Yeah. Oxytocin, and you can't, you really can't even... well, it's a bit like when a baby's born. You can't tell the difference between you and the other person. I mean, it's bliss. It's the best drug on earth, let's face it.
And then the blinkers fall off and you recognise that they park in bed or they wee on the seat and that kind of stuff.
But it's not, they're not even blinkers. It's just a condition of human existence that when those boundaries no longer exist, when you fall in love, those boundaries melt and they melt for a particular time and then they come back together because you're a human being. And then you have to negotiate the boundary, which wasn't there. Well, it just wasn't there. That's what's so confusing about it and why we keep on going back to it again and again and again and again. But there are so many other stories and we need to start telling them.
Thank you for listening to the Pleasure Podcast. If you enjoyed this, do share, review and subscribe on iTunes.
It really does help other people find us and gives the series a boost. Give us 5 stars, you lovely lad.
Thank you to Acast for hosting us,
Matt Peaver for editing us, Ollie Birch for the music,
and Gilad Vysotsky for the graphics.
Join us next time when we interview another guest for their insights on the relationship we have to our bodies, sex, and of course,
pleasure.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.